From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
Our human-centric way of looking at things in the garden and tasting, hearing, seeing, and touching things is just one person's opinion and hardly represents the consensus of all the living creatures whose home it is. Today's guest is naturalist Nancy Lawson, whom you may know as the Humane Gardener, the title of her previous book. She has a new one out called Wildscape that asks us to adjust our sense to take into account everyone out there whose world it is, everyone else whose world it is and was before we intervened. More in a moment, but first these messages.
Underwriting support from Color Blends, supplying top-quality spring-blooming Dutch flower bulbs to landscape professionals and ambitious home gardeners. More information on the web, colorblends.com.
Programming and underwriting support from High Mowing Organic Seeds, now offering 100% organic vegetable, flower, and herb seeds for that farm and garden. Available at highmowingseeds.com.
Nancy Lawson is the Humane Gardener, a naturalist and habitat consultant based in Maryland who promotes animal-friendly plant strategies and challenges us to sharpen our awareness that we're not alone out there. Her new book is Wildscape, and I'm so glad she's here today to talk about it. Hi, and so good to talk to you. Thank you.
Hi, Margaret. I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so we'll do a book giveaway with the transcript of this show over on awaytogarden.com. And so I just really just wanted to say, why did you want to write this book? I love the subhead on the title. It says Wildscape in big letters, and it says Trilling Chipmunks, Beckoning Blooms, Salty Butterflies, and Other Sensory Wonders of Nature. So why'd you want to do this one after The Humane Gardener?
Yeah, well, I felt like there's a lot of information out there now about how to garden for wildlife in general using plants. So people are much more aware of native plant gardening than they were even just a few years ago. But there are all these other things going on in the landscape that some of our more conventional landscaping practices that are still quite common, even among people trying to garden in a more gentler way, a lot of these conventional landscaping practices kind of smother some of the opportunities for animals to communicate through their senses, to perceive the world through their senses. And I just thought if people could think about a little bit more the fact that other organisms are not necessarily taking in their environment in the same way that we are, maybe they could also learn how to decrease their disruptions of those outdoor environments, because animals really need to be able to use that in a different way in order to survive and thrive.
Right. And by animals, we mean from the tiniest arthropod, insect and other arthropods, and even smaller to, well, not smaller, but but that small, to you know, like I have black bear who come wandering through the garden. You know what I mean? We mean animals on a wide range of, you know, not just squirrels and
the micro to the macro, right?
Yeah, there you go. So it's about sort of taking into consideration not just our own human senses and so, but all of their senses, and considering the sensory, I think, as you say in the book, considering the sensory experiences of the other species. You divided it up into these chapters that are about each sense, no big surprise there, which is great. And you really just ask us to pay so much closer attention instead of just being so, again, human-centric. In the intro to the book, you write, if you treat the local environment like the homeland it's meant to be, you'll be exposed to more cultures and ideas and ways of life than if you visited with people from every country in the world. I loved that. It's a real global perspective right in the backyard. So let's talk about that idea.
Yeah. So I mean, there's just an endless number of creatures out there that we'll never even be able to know them all or understand them all. And you know, the natural history studies are sort of done kind of on the side by a lot of scientists because they're not very well funded anymore. And a lot of these animals that people used to consider common and still do, we don't even know very much about their lifestyles, let alone, you know, some of the ones that haven't even been discovered yet. And so, I mean, I'm still discovering behaviors in my own backyard that hardly anyone else has seen. And
Yes. I love that. I love that. Me too. Me too.
yeah, and I think it, you know, we all could be contributing to the science of animal behavior and what animals need in you know our local floral and faunal communities. And if we just were able to take some time to pay attention a little bit more, like you said.
Yeah, and I think for me, one of the big ahas, even though I've been in the same place for like 35 years, I thought I knew the place, right? But I didn't really go out in the dark until the last maybe 10 years. I didn't go out in the dark, you know, after dark. I'm a gardener, right? So I'm out there during the day. And that was the other thing, was to learn about like the night shift too. You know what I mean? Not just the day shift, right?
I loved that. I remember when you wrote about that, about moths, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it turns out there's a lot when you go looking for moths, which I do at night in the summer, it turns out there's this whole other world of creatures. And in fact, a lot of creatures, because speaking of their needs, it's a great way to avoid predation is to be nocturnal, right? Because a lot of other animals that don't have good sight and so forth are diurnal or whatever. So, you know, so it's like a good time to crawl around and do your work and get your food and yeah.
And in fact, you know, larger animals like mammals, like coyotes, aren't necessarily people think of them as nocturnal, but these animals are just doing that to avoid us a lot of the time.
Right, an anti-predation strategy. Exactly. Yeah. No, it's very, very interesting. Yeah, so you'll see all these crazy things, and if you take your time, then you can try to figure out what they are, right? I mean, and that's the other part of it is not just go, oh, what's that? What's that? But actually find out what's that and what's it doing there and how long has it been doing that? And you know.
And a lot of times when you start to look things up, you realize that very few people have followed that trail before, or, you know, they might have studied a slightly similar animal or an animal, a related species of plant or animal. And so that's kind of what I focused on in my book when I couldn't find when I couldn't find an exact study or research or some other observations on what I was seeing, I could maybe at least find information on related species that could possibly give some insight into what I was looking at.
I loved seeing, and speaking of related species, I loved you have great pictures in the book, and you have this tortoise beetle. I think yours is a spotted tortoise beetle, maybe.
Yeah,
And yeah.
that's a scientist in Colorado took that picture.
Oh, sorry. And yeah, and I have a different. I saw it. And I said, oh, tortoise beetle. I have the clavate tortoise beetle, who sort of looks like a teddy bear under a piece of plexiglass, a little dome of plexiglass or something, you
I've
know.
seen
And
them, yeah.
yeah, and it's like well, the first time I saw that, I was like, what in the world? Who invented this thing, you know, and what's it doing, right?
It's amazing. Looks like a little tortoise, yeah.
So I, as I said, you know, there's just so many invocations in the book, you know, that you talk about, you know, how if we adjust our way of seeing and thinking, you know, you'll see, you know, the outdoors, even just your own backyard, is not really yours at all, but the gathering place of countless sovereign nations, a refuge for the increasingly displaced. So this like consciousness that we can make a difference with our decisions in our gardens and our parks and you know, other green spaces and so forth. A big difference.
Yeah, I mean, it, and, you know, in thinking about, a lot of people will ask, well, what's the first piece of advice you'd give someone when they want to start doing this? And I mean, first of all, it's like, just observe what's going on. Don't assume you have to change something. And watch who's coming through your space and things like that. But that also led me to thinking, oftentimes we just have to stop. We don't have to start doing something. We just have to stop. Stop mowing so much. Stop leaf blowing. Stop these sensory disruptions. Stop using, you know, all these pesticides that actually not only are directly damaging, but are, it turns out, putting out scents into the world that cause odor pollution that can disrupt flower fragrances and bees' ability to find the floral resources that they need. And so, I mean, there's all these different ramifications that are somewhat invisible to us unless we really think about it or someone decides to do some research on it.
So in a little bit, we have to sort of have a cease and desist order on ourselves sometimes. So again, the chapters are by the senses, and you talk about the scentscape, the soundscape, the tastescape, the touchscape, the sightscape. And I thought maybe we could just quickly, you know, kind of go through some of them, you know, just an example. And so I pulled out an example, like from the scentscape. You talk about something I didn't know. Everyone knows about monarchs and milkweeds and that close ancient relationship. But I didn't know about monarchs having a need and an interest in certain dead plants, I think is that sort of general way so tell us about that.
So I didn't know either until in the summer of 2019. I was just kind of wandering around the garden in the evening, admiring the flowers, taking pictures, and I saw a monarch on a bone set. And at first I thought that he was just kind of perching. And I'm glad I decided to zoom in. I have so many pictures of monarchs, I almost didn't. But I zoomed in, I took some video, and I realized that he was not leaving that plant at all, except when a car went by. And then he'd come right back, and he was sinking his proboscis into holes in the leaves, which they will go to injured leaves for these substances that they're extracting from certain plants, or more often they'll go to drying and dead leaves. Oh. And the substances that they're extracting are pyrrolizing alkaloids, and they are chemicals that butterflies in the tropics often use in their defense, and moths as well, and some grasshoppers and other species of butterflies also use them, synthesize them into pheromones. But monarchs aren't really thought to need to do that. So we think they're using them mainly in their defenses. And I when I first saw this, though, I had no idea what was going on. And I looked online, I tried to find research, and I finally posted to an insect group on Facebook. And I got a response from someone who was a retired lepidopterist from the Smithsonian. And he said, I think what you're seeing is leaf scratching, because that particular butterfly was scratching around a hole made by a flea beetle in the leaves. And that is something they sometimes do when they're trying to get at more of these substances. It's crazy. And they find them by some sort of scent that's released, but we don't exactly know what that scent is yet. It hasn't been captured. I've seen it many more times, and I ended up collaborating with a German chemical ecologist on writing up the observations and starting a community science project.
Huh.
Yeah.
So in the chapter, the soundscape, you have this woodpecker who's using this, you know, mushroom, this fungi covered tree stump, you know, is drilling into it. And you talk about how that's what we see that's going on, but there's this whole other layers that he's creating cavities, you know, excuse me, he's creating like little openings for potentially for cavity nesting bees to use as habitat and so forth. So there's this kind of like bigger picture that isn't visible to us right away, right?
Right. Yeah. The sounds are cues to many more things that are going on also in the tastescape in that example. Or, you know, the sounds would alert me to the presence when I really started just sitting quietly during the pandemic, trying to understand what was really going on around me in the soundscape. I would hear brown thrashers in the leaves, who I hardly ever see. I would start to hear more cuckoo birds, who are also very elusive. And that would help me make sightings as well. But it was only when I could sit for half an hour and have the animals start getting used to me and start hearing these tiny little sounds coming from the little woodland by the pond in front of me, or things like that.
Yeah. Yeah. You said the leaves, and I'm thinking, you know, the one sound that I love, it's a delicate sound, and I have to be somewhere and not moving around too much because obviously the bird's not going to like it if I'm causing interference. But is the sign when the towhees that used to be called rufous sided towhees, I forget what they're called now, when they come and they kind of kick in the leaf litter, you know what I mean? And it's very distinctive sound of spring and summer. And it's not like a chipmunk in the leaf litter, or do you know what I mean? Or a squirrel rustling around looking for, you know, a fallen acorn or something. It's a different sound. And there's these incredible subtleties if you become intimate enough with your environment.
Yes.
Everybody's at work, and many are at work in the leaf litter, but everyone has their different movement and their different timing, their different rhythm, and it makes a different sound. I know that sounds completely insane.
No, I think that's such a good point. I mean, because it's almost this other language that you get to know.
Yes.
They make different sounds because they're looking for different things. They have different ways of using their feet to kick things up, or beaks, or what have you. Yeah.
And then there's the chapter, the tastescape. So tell us something about the tastescape.
Yeah. So the tastescape, one of the most interesting things that we encountered here were the blister beetles, and they were in the back, and I see them almost every year almost exactly the same day, April 16th or 17th or 18th, they emerge, and we started seeing the little fire colored beetles on their backs, and we didn't know what it was at the time. They're much tinier, and it turns out that there's this whole thing going on where the fire colored beetles are actually chewing on the wings and legs of the blister beetles to get cantharidin. That's another chemical extraction situation, except this time it's animals going to animals, and they also use them probably in their defenses and possibly in mating. And and that took me down a whole trail of learning about this blister beetles and the fact that they parasitize bee nests and their larvae do, and they do it. We don't know that much about the blister beetle species in my area in Maryland, but in California, I talked to a scientist who had studied a similar relationship among related species, and she found that the larvae actually crawl up on a flower, and they aggregate to look like a bee and smell like a bee, a female bee, and they attract a male bee to come and think he's mating, and then they jump on that bee and then that male bee realizes what's going on and then goes and mates with a female bee who then picks up these larvae and goes back to her nest with them. And those little larvae eat the pollen and nectar and sometimes the baby bees. And so all of that sounds like, oh my gosh, poor bees, which I mean, you know, I feel that way about a lot of this predation parasitizing stuff. But
yes,
everybody's got to eat. And I just also think about what are the implications. You know, what are the broader implications of that? We have no idea. This is a relationship that's obviously natural, been going on a long time. And if maybe there's a certain check and balance thing so that certain bee species don't become too prolific and outcompete other ones. And it's just one example of so many wild things going on right under our noses.
Yes. Yes. In the chapter, The Touchscape, I love that you showed cuckoos in there. You mentioned cuckoos, I think, a minute ago, but, you know, who are like the only birds that can eat these spiny caterpillars, like tent caterpillars. And I think they can eat spongy moth or gypsy moth caterpillars. And it's fascinating how they're adapted to be able to make use of them as food, because that's a nasty, nasty thing to bite into.
Yes. Yes, it really is. And yeah, they just are able to kind of regurgitate all those spiny things and keep the good stuff. And it's amazing to learn about, they're sort of opportunistic nesters where they'll just go where they can find the most caterpillars. And so we also have a lot of white flannel moth caterpillars, which are these really gorgeous red and black and yellow and white caterpillars that tend to go on the red buds here. And when they come out, that's when the cuckoos are here. They and the fall webworms.
Right, right.
and they go where there are outbreaks of these caterpillars, because they need a lot of them really, really quickly. They build their nests really quickly. Sometimes they lay eggs in other birds' nests if they can't do it quickly enough. And so, you know, we need to be leaving those tent caterpillars and fall webworms and all these other creatures, not only they're wonderful in their own right. I mean, they're just little moths, right?
Right.
And they might be pollinating and all sorts of things, but also we need them for the birds.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah. And in the chapter, The Sightscape, I wondered if you could tell us the story of your sister's garden, which has turned out to make sort of a change in an important local law. For her homeowners association, at least. And, you know, just tell us a little bit of that. The Sightscape is kind of a lot of different things, but including when people object to what someone else's garden looks like. Yes. Like,
right.
Right. Front yard.
Right. Yeah. I decided to start the chapter with that because I felt like the Sightscape really, we tend to think about gardening only for our own senses, and sight dominates everything, right?
Yes.
So I in my sister's case, it was one neighbor who was very upset and didn't tell Janet and her husband Jeff, but went straight to the HOA board for years, wrote letters, and those letters were ignored for years until at one point he started signing them with his government signature, official signature, for some reason. And that's when the HOA board coincided with when they started to pay attention. And they cited her initially. They said she had weeds, and she has a mixed garden, lots of native plants, but also some non-native plants that they had planted before that they like to put in for color, annuals and such. And they So she wrote back an earnest letter that I helped her with and said we needed to do a little weeding, so we did that. But this is why we have this garden. Otherwise, it's for the birds. And so then she began getting letters that were attacking her for wanting to garden for the birds and said that
Oh,
a planned
jeez.
community is no place for welcoming birds and wildlife, and that it must all be green grass, is how they put it.
Right.
And so Janet fought for like 3.5 years and went to some local events, met some legislators, and our state delegates introduced legislation to prevent homeowners associations from being able to do this in the future, and the law passed in Maryland.
Well, we're gonna have a round of applause for that, and I think it's wonderful that it's your sister too. That's kind of a beautiful little, a beautiful story.
Yeah.
We've used up our time, but I'm so glad to speak to you. And excuse me, I hope we'll talk again soon. The book is Wildscape by Nancy Lawson. We're going to have a book giveaway with the transcript of the show over on awaytogarden.com. And I thank you so much for making time.
Thank you so much, Margaret.
You're welcome.
Underwriting support from Color Blends, supplying top quality spring blooming Dutch flower bulbs to landscape professionals and ambitious home gardeners. More information on the web, colorblends.com.
Programming and underwriting support from High Mowing Organic Seeds, now offering 100% organic vegetable, flower, and herb seeds for that farm and garden. Available at highmowingseeds.com.
And all of you, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Stitcher or on Spotify or on Apple Podcasts. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com and on Facebook and on Instagram as at awaytogarden. And happy gardening, including for wildlife, meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.